I gave a talk similar to this in Chicago, in a suburb of Chicago. And the title of the talk then was, Why Are We Here? And the answer to that question is, because we're not there. And there was the city of Chicago. What we're talking about here is a massive campaign against a massive reorganization of how Americans lived. And it began during World War II, slightly preceding World War II, and it began during World War II. During this period of time, the Catholics were the main focus of this campaign. Over the period of this period of time, the focus shifted, but during this period of time, when it began, the Catholics were perceived as a threat to America. I am not making this up. What we're talking about broadly here, the term we would use is called social engineering. We don't hear much about social engineering these days, but it was a hot topic during World War II, during the middle of World War II. There was a book that was written at this time. It was the book is called The American Dilemma, and it's about the race issue in the United States. The author is a Swede by the name of Gunnar Myrdal. What I discovered during this research into this book was that Gunnar Myrdal did not and could not have written this book. The book was 1,200 pages, which is short in comparison to the books that I write. He arrived in 1939. The war broke out. He left right after the war broke out and went back to Sweden. He could not have written a 1,200-page book in 1 year, especially since the first year he spent doing nothing but traveling around the United States. What was this book about? To get to the heart of it, it goes back to a change in psychology. 1930, a famous psychologist by the name of John B. Watson wrote a new edition of his book, Behaviorism. And he said there was fear out there, that there was social experimentation going on, and he said, shouldn't worry about it. He said, first of all, this is a quote from the book, we must all admit that social experimentation is going on at a very rapid rate at present, and an alarmingly rapid rate for comfortable conventional souls. And he says, as an example of social experimentation, we have war. War is always the front for social engineering. Nothing has changed in this regard. The massive social engineering that took place in Catholic neighborhoods and parishes during the 1950s had all been prepared for by World War II. World War II was the justification for massive changes in the way we lived in America. More recently, 9/11 and the war in the Middle East was also the stage, the excuse, the pretext for massive changes in the way Americans lived. That's more recently in our mind. Myrdal says this in his book. He says, from the point of view of social science, which is his word for social engineering, this means, among other things, that social engineering will be increasingly demanded. Doesn't say by whom. Many things that for a long period have predominantly been a matter of individual adjustment will become more and more determined by political decision and public regulation. We are entering an era where fact-finding and scientific theories of causal relations will be seen as instrumental in planning controlled social change. The peace, this came out in 42, will bring nothing but problems, one mounting upon another, and consequently new urgent tasks for social engineering. The American social scientist, because of the New Deal and the war, is already acquiring familiarity with planning and practical action. He will never again be given the opportunity to build up disinterested social science. Science is a weapon, and the main instrument, the main headquarters of that weapon was the University of Chicago, founded by the Rockefeller family. The beginning of the social sciences in America. Okay, now, Gunnar Myrdal's name is on that book, but as I said, he did not write it. This book was written by what was then the psychological warfare establishment of the United States. Once the war started, there were creations of special agencies, intelligence agencies. One of them was the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services. Another was the OWI, the Office of War Information. One of the people who was involved with the Office of War Information was a man by the name of Lewis Wirth. Lewis Wirth was a professor at the University of Chicago at this time. He was a Jew from Koblenz in Germany, born into a family of Jewish cattle merchants. He came to the United States because he had an uncle that supported him here. He rose quickly through the ranks of the social science establishment. He taught at a Catholic college in New Orleans, Loyola, and got fired and held a grudge against the Catholic Church ever since that time. This grudge came out during the war when he started writing reports on the situation in America. The key event at this time was the race riot in Detroit in 1942. Detroit became one of the crucial areas, one of the crucial choke points for what we're talking about here. Because when the war broke out, we suddenly lost 11 million workers. These workers had to be made up somewhere or other. Women, okay, we'll try and get women in, but there was only one pool of untapped labor in the United States at that point, and those were the black sharecroppers down south. So what we had to do was bring these black sharecroppers up north so they could work in the factories of places like Detroit, the Willow Hill bombing factory. One of the Ford plants was taken over and created, made bombers. So within a six-month period, you had 250,000 black sharecroppers arrive in Detroit. These people were living under a system of segregation. They were held down by a whole legal system that kept them in bondage. And they came up north, and there was no segregation. There was no segregated water fountains. And for the most part, like many immigrants, I'd say like most immigrants, it seemed as if the old world had been suspended. The moral law no longer applied, and they went crazy. South side of Chicago is no different. The blues on the south side of Chicago, and so on and so forth. And the government at this point decided we have to have some place for them to stay. And so they started building projects in Polish neighborhoods. Now, if you know Detroit, it's a wide open space. When you head to the west, there's nothing but wide open spaces. There are plenty of empty lots. And why are you building this in the Polish neighborhood? Well, the answer is, again, Lewis Wirth. Lewis Wirth went there after the riot. The riot took place in 42. You had black migrants coming back home on a Sunday evening from Belle Isle, the kind of resort, the island in the middle of the Detroit River, getting into fight with white people. Huge riot, biggest race riot in the history of the United States. Lewis Wirth is there to investigate it, and he realizes that it's basically what do you expect? You get 250,000 people who are completely unaccustomed to living in big cities, impinging on the neighborhoods that are already there, have been settled according to the unwritten constitution of the United States, which is basically that ethnic colonies can establish, the ethnic groups from Europe can establish their own colonies when they come. They have their own neighborhoods. You know the story, you know, Chinatown, Germantown, Little Italy. One place after another. Why do they have those names? Well, because the immigrants came there and they settled there and they had their own sort of organization there. Okay, this at this point in time, that constitution was simply torn up and thrown away, and the social engineers took over because America was now going to become an imperial power, and in order to project power outward, we had to have a docile population at home that would support unquestioningly those foreign adventures. And that's what this was about. So we couldn't have any dual allegiances of the sort that you had in Catholic ethnic parishes. So the Polish pastor of St. Louis, the King Parish, wrote to the federal government in Washington and said, why are you doing this? We're loyal Americans, you know, why are you doing this? And got no answer. because they couldn't give him an honest answer. The honest answer came from Louis Wirth when he gave an analysis of America according to the real armature of America, which is ethnic, it's not racial. Race is there to confuse you because there's no such thing as a white person, especially if you're up north. This is something that Martin Luther King found out a long time ago. Down south, one of his lieutenants said, down south, you was either black or white. You wasn't none of this Polish or Irish or any of that kind of stuff. They didn't confuse it. That was the situation in the north. That was the situation that Louis Wirth was upset about because of these dual loyalties. First of all, to the country you came from, and secondly, to the Catholic Church, which was the source of the organization of your community. Your community was a physical piece of land. It was a parish. A parish is geographical. It's different than a society. Max Weber talked in one of his books about the difference between Gemeinschaft and Gesellschaft. Gemeinschaft is community, Gesellschaft is society. A society is people have interests, like stamp collectors. They all get together and talk about stamps. That's not a community. A community is a physical piece of property where the people live there and live with each other and communicate with each other and share a series of values. This is what Louis Wirth declared war on. And he did it as a representative of the University of Chicago, of the Rockefellers, of the elites like the Ford Foundation, and of the United States government. And this is also the beginning of something that would haunt us until this day, namely covert warfare. This is the beginning of covert warfare. And it is also the beginning of proxy warfare. All of these things are new terms, and they all had their genesis in this period beginning in World War II. So where did Louis Wirth get his ideas? Louis Wirth was, as I said, a Jew and a communist. His daughter conveniently left this out in the anthology of the material that he wrote when she wrote this stuff, but he was a communist. And as a communist, he took his role very seriously, and he was taking his orders from Stalin, who was the head of the Soviet Union at that time and the center of the world communist conspiracy. And what was Stalin talking about at this time? What are we talking about in the period right beginning after the war begins and Germany is now marching toward Russia? Well, they got the same problem. Stalin has the same problem. The Soviet Union is made up of ethnic groups. There are all kinds of ethnic groups. My daughter-in-law is a Russian, but she's not really Russian. She's German and she's Tatar. She got the Catholic faith from her grandmother, who was Volgadeutsch, who was brought over centuries ago. At this point, Stalin realized that he felt he couldn't trust these people, and Louis Wirth got the same idea from Stalin, and he wrote in one of these reports to the federal government, there are certain people who are suspect because of their origin. Now, you explain to me how this fits into all of the official narratives of the United States of America. Where does it say in the Constitution, or where does it say in the Declaration of Independence, that certain people are suspect because of their origin? No, it's supposed to be a pluribus unum. Remember all that type of stuff, blah, blah, blah. This is totally anti-American, what we're talking about here. And then it gets worse. Then he starts actually listing who these people are who are suspect by their because of their origin. Germans. Okay, we're at war with Germany. Italians, okay, we're at war with Italy. The Irish, well, wait a minute. The Irish, we're not at war with the Irish. And then the Polish, well, wait a minute. I thought we were fighting on the side of the Poland against. So then you think, well, wait a minute. What do these four groups have in common? They're Catholic. And suddenly the whole picture begins to emerge. Catholics are suspect. Catholics are second-class citizens. Catholics are people who need to be socially engineered. And so this takes off after we defeat fascism, after we. What do you mean we, paleface? You know that joke, don't you? The Lone Ranger and Tonto you know, the Lone Ranger turns to Tonto and he says, "This is my last bullet, Tonto, but I wanted to let you know that, you know, when we go, we're both going to go together." And Tonto says, "What you mean, we, Paleface?" Here we are, supposedly fighting a war, and the war, and we are the enemy, and no one is telling us. Well, actually, people were telling us. After the war, a man by the name of Paul Blanchard wrote a book called American Freedom and Catholic Power about how the Catholics, now that the United States had defeated fascism, now the Catholics were the new enemy. And there was a sense that the Catholics are taking over the world in these circles. Adenauer, head of Germany, he's a Catholic. De Gaulle's a Catholic. Franco's a Catholic. The guy in Portugal's a Catholic. They're taking over the world, and we have to do something. And they were dead serious, and they had the wherewithal to do it, and they did it with, at the same time, they were brilliant the way they did it. At the same time, they were trying to get the Catholics involved in the anti-communist crusade. They're working against them in their own neighborhoods, destroying their own neighborhoods. And so as a result, you had a state of civil war in the big cities of the North, beginning in 1946 with the airport project riots in Chicago, all the way up. Where do you want to take it? To Southie? The busing riots in Southie in 1974? The destruction of Pole Town in 1980 under Ronald Reagan? You had one continual series state of war. Literally war. Gang war, it was called. Okay? My wife was a teacher in Philadelphia in 1971 in one of these contested neighborhoods in Southwest Philadelphia, where the only people who were demonized were the Catholics. They were called white people. They had a gang called the Dirty Annies. We knew that because you could read in the newspaper. You mean there were no black gangs in this neighborhood? How come we only hear about white gangs? And then she has this couple that moves from Ireland. They have two kids. She gets the young girl in kindergarten, and the older boy gets killed in a gang fight because he's white. He didn't even know he was white. He thought he was Irish. And he showed up here in the middle of a race war, and he got killed. This is the covert war that was going on in the United States, and it led to the complete emptying out of the South Side of Chicago. And that the point here is, you're kind of a western suburb of Chicago out here, I think. The point here is that that's why we're here. Because we got emptied out of what were actual, viable, living communities. There are pictures of, I believe it's Visitation Parish. They had a high school for girls. The parish had a high school for girls. And this is the graduation ceremony. On both sides of the street, you have girls in cap and gowns as far as you can see. One side is the school band, and the other side is the graduates themselves. These are viable communities. These are people who live together, who walk down the street with each other, who bump into each other at the grocery store, who go on vacation to the same type of place. They were destroyed. Literally destroyed by covert warfare. And it was called eliminating segregation. We didn't have segregation in Chicago. There were no white water fountains in Chicago. It was the old rule. In the 20s, Cicero was a Czech neighborhood. They had riots in Cicero when a German moved into a Czech neighborhood. That wasn't racial, that was ethnic. And so what you had was basically the use, remember, the American dilemma is about race. It's about how America is going to solve its race problem. And so what you had was basically this use, this problem, which only existed in the South, being transposed to the entire country as a way of destroying any type of opposition to the empire's desire to project force outward based on a completely homogeneous population. And so what you had during this period of time is the creation of pseudo-groups, pseudo-communities. They're all over the place. Sports teams, I hate to say this, are pseudo-communities. They are pseudo-ethnic communities where you have pseudo-ethnic clothing. Okay, you go to Cincinnati during a Bengals game and you see all of these people wearing orange T-shirts. They have no other way of identifying themselves as a group, because their groups have been destroyed. If you go to Findlay Market, my son, my youngest son lives in Cincinnati, and he lives in over near, he used to live in Over the Rhine, now he lives near Over the Rhine, which was the German neighborhood. And Findlay Market is kind of the center of this neighborhood. And you go there, and there is no conflict. There's no racial conflict. Everybody loves Findlay Market. You can associate with people freely. You know, it's a great place. But they have a plaque there apologizing to the Germans for the way the city of Cincinnati treated the Germans during World War I. And that's before even the big advance that we're talking about now. So you have the replacement of real communities with pseudo-communities. Harley Davidson riders. I don't want to offend any Harley Davidson riders here. I know some of you showed up on your hogs, and I don't want you to take this personally. NASCAR. I don't want to offend that group either. NASCAR dads. The best example I had was I did an article about Gray's Ferry, which is another ancient Irish neighborhood in Philadelphia. And these poor guys are being driven out in street fighting, block by block. They're being driven out by the same group. It's the black people who are moving in and displacing the Irish. And they're doing this with the complete and total support of the city of Philadelphia. And anytime there's an incident, it's always the Irish from Grays Ferry who are at fault. If there's an interracial fight, it's always the Irish who are at fault, like this. And I tried to come in there, and I tried to, you know, where do you communicate? Well, I have to go to a bar to communicate with people, because that's the only place where people hang out. And what do they do at a bar? I mean, you drink, obviously, but what do you do when you're drinking at a bar? Tell me. You watch television, and you're watching sports. And so here I am coming. I wrote a book. I wrote a book here. It's about you. You know, it's about you guys being destroyed. Would you like to buy a copy of my book? How much is it? It's $25. I spent 7 years doing research. I made about 10 cents an hour writing this book. I'm charging you 25. That's too much. Oh, wait a minute. And he turns to the guy next to him. Put $50 on the Sixers. So he's betting $50. These are people who have been totally colonized by this ultra sophisticated form of social control. That's why we don't have communities now, because we don't know what happened to us. And so the good news is that consciousness is now being raised. Okay, our consciousness of what is happening is now reaching the point where I think we're almost to the point where we may be able to write our history. And our history, meaning the Catholics of the United States, is the history of covert warfare. That's what it is. We were the guinea pigs in a social experiment that nobody told us about. Believe me, we know a lot more now than we did when I was 20 years old, because no one knew anything when I was 20 years old. It was the middle of the battle. It was the middle of the revolution. I was 20 years old in 1968, when Michael was still in diapers. Nobody knew anything about what's going on now. The victims were not just white people. In 2006, I wrote a book. I thought I had finished The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. And I got a call from a black lady, friend of mine from the South Side of Chicago, Gloria Hardy. She had taken me into the Robert Taylor Homes, the projects, when I was doing a book on architecture, which is for sale out there, Living Machines. I was the first white guy in the project since the last worker left and turned the lights out. Walk in there, take the elevator up, you know, the elevator doesn't work, you pry the door open, and there's this guy with a tracksuit and gold chains enough to strangle him around his neck, and the look of shock on his eyes is, what's this white guy doing here in the projects? Gloria called me, and during that time we had with her, she's a social worker, she said someone came to her, crack addict who was pregnant with twins, and she wanted money for an abortion. And Glory, instead of giving her the money for abortion, adopted the twins. And I had sort of grown up with them. You know, they'd come down to South Bend, and Ivory, you know, at one point used to call me Dad. And then I got a call, and now Ivory's pregnant. She's 18 years old. She's pregnant, and it sounds as if she's living with a pimp. And Glory is, well, what do we do? Wow, what do we do? So I go up to Chicago and I'm walking around. Actually, I wore the suit. Always wear a suit on the south side of Chicago because they think you're a cop. So I'm walking around with Ivory. I'm trying to be the father that she never had, you know? And I'm thinking, what is this mess? What is this mess? Why does this thing keep replicating itself? These are the people. These are the people that drove our people out. And they're even worse off than we are. Gloria's parents came from Mississippi. No, who knows where Ivory? I don't know where Ivory. I don't know who Ivory's parents are. She doesn't know who her parents are. But it was all this black migration. The federal government used these people as the shock troops, as their proxy warriors. And now the situation is just one big mess. Okay? Why is that? Well, because this social engineering doesn't stop. So what did they do? They created this group of warriors. I just got back from Iran. I'm trying to explain this to the Iranians. I said, well, it's just exactly what the United States did in Afghanistan with the Mujahideen. They're proxy warriors. We gave them guns, told them to go kill the Soviet soldiers. And they went and did that. And guess what happened? They won. And guess what happened after that? They didn't stop existing. They were all psyched up because they just had destroyed the Soviet Union. And you've got this army of people who now have the most radical form of Islam in their minds. I mean, Wahhabism. The stuff that the madrasas that the Saudis created in Pakistan, turning them into people who believe that God is pure will. There's no logos in God, and we can do whatever we want because will is the supreme good. And now they're ready to go someplace else. And these people have caused chaos for the last 30 years, including what's going on in Syria, direct line to Syria. Well, guess what happened? The black people were exactly the same thing on the south side of Chicago. Gloria was 18 years old in 1966, which is when Martin Luther King came to Chicago. And one of the first things that Martin Luther King did when he came to Chicago was meet with the Blackstone Rangers. What were the Blackstone Rangers? They were criminals. What do criminals do? Well, they engage in crime. You're shocked to hear that, I know. Why was he talking to the Blackstone Rangers? Well, because he needed them. Because what was going on here was just criminal agitation, making life impossible for the orderly Catholic parishes that existed on the south side. That they had to be driven. They just threw up their hands and said, I've had it. I can't take it anymore. And then they leave. And what happens when you leave Chicago and you move to the suburbs? You stop being Polish or Irish and you become a white person. You become a middle-class white person. And you sit behind your car and you drive your car home and then you turn on your television. And then when you have some free time, you mow your lawn. And what do all these things have in common? They are completely isolating asocial activities because you are completely isolated from the group that you belong to and you've got nothing in common with this other than the fact that you spent the same amount for your house. That was the role that the Blackstone Rangers played in Chicago. They are what Karl Marx would call the Lumpenproletariat. They're good for nothing except disturbing things. Sergeant Shriver, head of the Office of Economic Opportunity, gave the Blackstone Rangers $1 million. During the church hearings of 1976, it came out that these people, the government knew that they were engaged in criminal activity. The cops in Chicago are totally bewildered. They cannot figure out what's going on. The Black Panthers arrive in Chicago, Black Panther Party. Gloria joins the Black Panthers. Black Panthers came from Oakland, California. Black Panthers are a Jewish creation. It's a Jewish revolutionary fantasy. David Horowitz, now the neoconservative, was the fundraiser for the Black Panthers back then. He's the guy who probably wrote Soul on Ice, even though they put Eldridge Cleaver's name on it. He got money from Bert Schneider, who was the producer of Easy Rider. This was Hollywood money. This was, in many ways, the culmination of what is known as the Black Jewish Alliance. For 60 years, from 1909, with the founding of the NAACP, up to 1969, when the Black Panthers came to Chicago, the Jewish organizations like the NAACP, the ADL, funded revolutionary groups because they were trying to promote a revolution. Martin Luther King was no exception to this rule. He, Stanley Levinson, a Jewish communist from New York City, raised $200,000 a year to fund his operation. Martin Luther King would never have gone to Chicago if it weren't for this outside influence. So at this point, as I said, the same thing that happened in Afghanistan happened in Chicago. These people created a monster. Suddenly all these people, the FBI becomes involved, feel they have to do something. They send an agent there, agent provocateur, who starts buying guns. They stockpile guns. Then the same agent provocateur calls up the Chicago police, says the Black Panthers are stockpiling guns. And as a result, the police come in and they kill everybody. That's what's probably going to happen to ISIS. Sorry, fellas, you're the Frankenstein monster we created. You've outrun, you're out of control. We're going to kill you now. Happens all the time. So it happened in Chicago. At this point, Gloria is terrorized. There's no Black Panther Party anymore. The entire population, Black population of the South Side of Chicago is terrorized. And at this point, the rulers, the masters of the universe, step in again, and it's time to create a new paradigm. The new paradigm is the pimp. We had the Black Revolutionary. Remember Huey Newton? You can Google it. Huey Newton sitting with his black beret, his afro, on that rattan chair, holding a spear in one hand and a gun in another. Okay, that was the old paradigm. The new paradigm is Superfly. Maybe you remember, it's called Blaxploitation now. Blaxploitation films, the big film thing of the 70s. It was created by a man called Gordon Parks. Gordon Parks was a black photographer for Life magazine. He is the guy who created this. Gordon Parks was working for the CIA. Time, Life, and the CIA, this comes out in the John Courtney Murray book, which I have out for sale. This is Time, Life. This is the CIA. We'll do the Venn diagram. It's like that. Okay, the crucial link was a man by the name of C.D. Jackson, who was President Eisenhower's campaign manager. He went in the White House in 1953, and within 6 months, we had the coup d'etat in Iran, toppling Mossadegh. There's a direct line between that and Gordon Parks, because C.D. Jackson was the guy who gave Gordon Parks his money to do Superfly. So the CIA is the producer of Superfly. Why is that? Well, we need a new paradigm. We want to dial down this black revolutionary stuff. This is passé now. And you know what? It worked. It worked. Because in 1972, the black folk on the South Side of Chicago lined up around the block to see Superfly, and then Shaft, and then all these other, you name it. There are parodies of blaxploitation films now called I'm Going to Get You, Sucker, and Undercover Brother. You know, the big guy, you know, the guy, the Cadillac Eldorado, the canary yellow maxi coat with the big hat and the elevator platform shoes. You know what I'm talking about. You don't know that? Where you been, honey? You were alive in 74. Why weren't you going to the movies? I was too. So what happens? What happens? What happens is when you, the sexual engineering of the black population. What do you mean by sexual engineering? What is the basis for society? The basis for society is the family. The family is like a molecule. It's like an atom, okay? When you split the atom, what happens? You release all kinds of destructive energy, and this is precisely what happened in Chicago. The violence went off the charts. Now, I was in Iran to talk about the racial conflict in the United States. The racial conflict has been reignited in a city called Ferguson, where one guy got shot by a policeman. On the South Side, in Chicago this past year, 430 people were murdered. 80% of them were black. Do black lives matter? Then why aren't we talking about Chicago? 2 years after Superfly came out, we're talking about the sexualization of this black community, which didn't have strong family bonds to begin with because of the black migration. The black family was in real crisis when it got to Chicago. And now you have this Superfly coming out and you have all these black dudes imitating a pimp. Do you think that's going to help your sexual morals? No, it's not. And so what happened, 1974, 970 people were murdered in Chicago. 970, the all-time high 2 years after the sexual re-engineering of the people in Chicago. 80% of those people were black. Why are we not talking about this? Because we live in a world where information is a weapon, where culture is a weapon that is used against the people who live in that culture. That's what's going on right now. What we're seeing is the proxy warfare once again. I talked to you about the Jewish Revolution, the Jewish revolutionaries. The book I wrote is The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. All of the story of the Black Jewish Alliance is in that book, it's part of that book. I said for 60 years that the Jews, through organizations like the NAACP, the Communist Party, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the Black Panthers, tried to turn the black people into revolutionaries. As if it were in the past. I thought it was in the past until Ferguson breaks out, and now we have racial conflict back on the front page again. Who's behind Ferguson? It's George Soros. George Soros has spent $33 million supporting Black Lives Matter, Ferguson. I could go down the list, blah, blah, blah. I'll read you the names if you want me to. But here we have, it's a resurrection of the same thing. And so no one's allowed to talk about it. No one's allowed to talk about it. And this gives you some indication of what the word white means. White is mystification. I'm not white. I can't tell you how tired I get telling people I'm not white. You know, I'm biracial. I'm Irish and German. These people didn't know they were white until they came over here. Do you mean those Polish people in Wrocław? They wake up in the morning and say, well, what are the white race going to do today? They didn't know they were white till they came here and it was instrumentalized. Why is this white-black conflict so important? Because it's a form of mystification that keeps us from understanding what is happening. Because when it comes to the South Side of Chicago, the blacks and the whites were both victims. They were thrown into a battle being orchestrated by people above them. And as long as we can focus on this battle of black people and white people, we'll never figure out the identity of the people who are promoting this thing from the top, people like George Soros. It's happening now. This, I'm sorry to say, was my experience in Chicago. In Tehran. There are people, black people, who are just as heavily invested in this dialectic as the white people are. The result is mayhem. One of the people Gloria introduced me to was a woman by the name of Carolyn Peoples. She met her as a social worker, Carolyn Peoples. Was a prostitute. She was born in 1977. During this period of time, she went the same pathology that is pandemic across the South Side of Chicago. The father leaves. Before he leaves, he comes up from the South. He goes crazy when he comes up from the South. He starts drinking and whoring around. Okay, the mother finds it intolerable. He's intolerable. He comes in the middle of the night and in the middle of the winter in Chicago, breaks all the windows in their apartment, pours water over Carolyn's blanket so she can't stay warm. Who did that? What's the problem? Is this white racism? That's the conventional narrative. The whole problem here is white racism. This is not white racism, okay? So he leaves. Well, her mother is not going to sit home alone. Her mother brings boyfriend in. Once the boyfriend comes in, there is no incest barrier in the home anymore. This means that you have massive child molestation going on in these families. This causes enormous amounts of violence. Carolyn leaves home at the age of 13 because she can't stand it anymore, and she goes where? Where do you go? Well, she joins a gang. She joins the Gangster Disciples. From there, it's to prostitution. From prostitution, she starts to realize that she hates what she's doing, as prostitutes do. She starts to hate the people she's involved with. She starts to hate all men. She starts to realize the only way you make money dancing at the skybox is if you engage in sexual activity. Okay, I'll go to the motel. And then the guy hands you a $20 bill and it dawns on her, I could take his whole wallet. And so she takes a gun the next time. And she holds the guy up and she does this any number of times because the people are ashamed to identify her because of the compromising situation they're in. And then she meets her cousin Angela. And Angela is taking care of a guy. She's a nurse. She's taking care of a guy named Jose. And Jose's got a lot of money. And suddenly she realizes, we could take this money, but Jose's going to know who we are. So Carolyn goes in, and she starts dancing in front of him. And Angela goes behind him, takes out the gun, and shoots him in the back of the head. And takes all his money. And suddenly realizes, now, from now on, it's murder. I'm not going to take $20. I'm just going to take your wallet. I'm going to kill you. And so Carolyn is now in prison because she's a serial killer. Now, where did that come from? Is that because they have segregated water fountains in Chicago? No. It's because of the social engineering of the black family, which was the antidote to the social engineering of the Catholic neighborhoods. It goes on and on and on and on. And I'm saying, if black lives really matter, this is what we got to talk about. Thank you.